Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:04 a.m. on Wednesday, March 14th. Present today, March 14th, 2019. Present today, we have Representative Knopp, Representative Tilton. Representative LeBon is currently in a finance subcommittee, but will be here in a bit. Representative Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Wilson, Representative Ortiz, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And as we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And this morning, the committee will finish up our meeting from yesterday on the University of Alaska. And so if there are no questions before we begin, I would like to call up both OMB Director Donna Ardwin, as well as Mr. Mike Barnhill, Policy Director for OMB. And if you could both put yourselves on the record, and thanks for being here, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Donna Ardwin, Director of the Office of Management and Budget for the Governor.
Mike Barnhill, Policy Director, OMB. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to take the committee through the technical presentation of the University of Alaska budget. And perhaps just to reiterate a point that was made yesterday, as Policy Director at the Office of Management and Budget, I simply confine my role to policy with respect to budget development. I do not, have not, will not give any policy direction to the University of Alaska, though we have had some interesting conversations where we have exchanged ideas. I also want to just express appreciation for President Johnson and his professionalism throughout this discussion. Much appreciated. Respect for the committee and for the process. So starting on this first page, President Johnson took us through an equivalent to this page and the following page. These are the basic bar charts that illustrate the revenue sources for the University of Alaska budget. There are two views on these two pages. One is with combined unrestricted general fund and designated general fund. That's on the first page here. And on the second page, we break that out into separate sections of the bar for unrestricted and designated. Top line view is FY19 management plan. The legislature appropriated a total of $888,547,000.8 for the university, the majority of which is in the form of designated and unrestricted general funds. For FY20, that amount is increased slightly to $901.4 million. With respect to the budgeted positions, there's no change at 3,993. The real details are on the next page, where we get to see more of what's going on here. Basically, what we're showing here is a decrease in unrestricted general fund, as the committee well knows, of a total of $134 million unrestricted general fund, coupled with an increase of $154 million in designated general fund. And the purpose for the increase is simply to increase the university's authority to seek and collect other funds to assist in making up for the reduction in unrestricted general fund of $134 million. There's no policy expectation that they do that in any particular way. So for instance, President Johnson has said we could do that by doubling tuition. There's no policy expectation from the administration that the university double tuition, nor any expectation that that approach would even be realistic. And I think I was quoted yesterday by Representative Josephson as saying doubling tuition would be impossible, and I think that's correct.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. So since you brought it up, so where would the administration expectation be if it's not in tuition, which I agree that you can't, well, you could double tuition, but I'm pretty sure that would be pretty devastating to those who are in school right now. So as you were looking at bringing the DGF up, what funds did you see that were possibly available out there that the university has not taken advantage of?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, all universities have available to them a variety of funding sources, but I don't think it's realistic to expect that the university, in short order, could tap all of the existing revenue sources to make up this cut. I think if this were to be implemented, if the legislature or if the appropriation ultimately reflected this cut, it would be implemented in a variety of ways, looking for additional revenues from other sources, increasing tuition, implementing some of the cuts.
Follow up? So again, and I'm just not aware, is why I'm asking the question, is besides tuition, you know, you made it sound like the administration knew of other specific sources that they could possibly tap that they are currently not tapping. I'm just trying to get an idea of what those resources are.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't mean to give the impression that I am aware of specific resources. I am aware that universities elsewhere, including the University of Alaska, avails themselves of a variety of fund sources when they prepare a budget, and that includes going to alumni in a capital campaign, includes leveraging federal dollars, it includes going to private sector for fundraising, it includes tuition.
Follow up.
Coupled with that, the opportunity to make consolidations and cost reductions.
First of all, I do believe that the university has reductions that they can make, and I do believe President Johnson has kind of been on that trail and was telling us how when someone starts a major, you can't just cut the program off. You have to give them that opportunity to be able to do it. But one thing that the president did bring up yesterday was what you just said about leveraging funds. So by taking this large amount out, do you know whether or not it will impact some of what they're leveraging currently? And will it also make it harder to be able to go get the funds, as he had talked about, that they were doing yesterday because of the reduction? Or was that even looked into at all?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have specific familiarity with the types of funds that they leverage from the federal government. However, I am almost completely sure that raising funds from the federal government in the university higher education context is not the same as leveraging funds, for instance, in the Medicaid context where there's a dollar-for-dollar match. I know of other universities, for instance, later in the slide deck I referenced Michigan State University's research program. They match on a 29-to-1 basis. The University of Alaska matches on a 6-to-1 basis. I believe there are other opportunities. Can they be tapped overnight? I have no idea. But I believe there are resources there.
It'd be nice to know what they are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative, okay. No other questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Barnhill, for your presentation today. And I appreciated your comments about how, while you're a policy person, you don't actually direct policy towards the university itself. Appreciate that. However, with the $134 million reduction in UGF, is it safe to say that the administration has made a very clear policy statement that they don't see the state of Alaska continuing to support the university system, that they no longer merit the continued support from the state of Alaska as they move forward? Is that a fair statement, a fair policy statement to make?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, no, I really don't think it is. I think the position that the Dunleavy administration would take with respect to the university is it's very important in the life of Alaska. The state is continuing to support it through an appropriation of approximately $190 million in this budget. It's evident from elsewhere that publicly funded universities not only survive but thrive with less funding. And we believe from a policy perspective that the University of Alaska can be supported with this level of funding, can grow, can achieve high quality education and excellence. The question is, how do we get there from here?
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Barnhill, in preparation for my oversight of the Finance Subcommittee, the first thing I did was listen to the two hearings in the other body on February 19th. And in those hearings, Senator Olson asked the President, what would happen to your other sources of funds if we decreased UGF by 41%? And he said that there would be no, he said essentially they would move into a negative number. I think his point was you couldn't sustain the DGF, all of the federal grants and the other sources of revenue. And in a perfect world, I would, this would be all I do, and I would go research the veracity or the accuracy of what the President said, but I have no reason to question his credibility on that. And the administration's not giving me any evidence, concrete evidence, that the opposite is true, or that there's some other third truth, or whatever. So my concern is we reduce the blue bar and the others will collapse. Why shouldn't I just believe that that's true?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think ultimately it's a question of the path that we pick going forward. Can we achieve this? With some paths, I think we can. But all of this is an exercise in predicting the future. I'm not going to quarrel with you that reducing the unrestricted general fund by 41% is disruptive to the university. The question is, how can we implement that in the least disruptive way? And I'm here to share with the committee some information on how we develop the budget, some thoughts for going forward, not policy direction. And I believe there is a way forward for the university. And I believe that because other universities have traveled this path.
Follow up. I would like to hear about a specific instance where there was a 41% cut in a single year from another university and its success story. I need to hear about that. Thank you.
If no other questions or comments, let's see, Mr. Barnhill.
So, Mr. Chair, the next page identifies a reduction. So first I should just say background. The University of Alaska used to have, like other state agencies, multiple appropriation lines. A few years ago, the university came to the legislature and asked that all of the appropriations lines be rolled up into one appropriation. We've had that now for a few years. The Dunleavy administration is proposing. It's a proposal. The legislature owns the appropriation authority, but we are proposing to unroll it into two components, a university component and a community campus component. And I'll get into the details for why we're proposing that in a few moments, but what this slide shows is that this would be a net reduction of $154 million from the university section of the university campus section of the budget, and an increase of $20.4 million for the community campus. That's a net reduction of $134 million. In terms of budget development, I'd like to provide some information and transparency as to our analysis that we engaged in preparing this for the governor. The first thing we did was compare revenues and expenditures of the University of Alaska, and we compared with other publicly funded universities using existing national data. We compared with other land grant universities, of which there are about 100 land grant universities in the United States, using nationally available data. And then finally, we looked at revenues and expenditures within the University of Alaska just to get a sense at a more granular level as to where the revenue is being allocated, where are the expenses being borne, what are the cost drivers. And that data came from the university itself as part of the budget process. So just to start with the comparisons of costs, revenues.
Mr. Barnhill, maybe before we go on to this next slide, we've got a few questions. Representative Ortiz and then Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to slide 10. really a $154 million reduction going to the University of Alaska system-wide campuses and an increased state contribution for University of Alaska community campuses. First of all, can you define what a community campus would be? Would that be like UAS Ketchikan, my own campus? Is that what you're referring to when you say that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, and President Johnson referenced yesterday, there are 13 community campuses. If we were to jump to slide 17, 18, and 19, each of those, well, almost all of the community campuses are reflected on that spreadsheet. And if you'd like, I can just identify them. Okay.
Just as a follow-up, thank you. So was that shifting of resources a result of some specific communication back and forth between yourself and the university, President Johnson, for example, that requested that kind of shift? Is that what that was?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, no, there was no request from the university. This is a suggestion born of our analysis of the budget, as well as actually, President Johnson made a number of comments yesterday that support the idea of infusing the community campus system with additional resources. If you want to jump to that right now, I'm happy to go through each of those reasons, but I see you have another question, so I'll pause.
It's not so much a question, Mr. Chairman. So then at least it would be safe to say, if there wasn't any clear communication between the administration and the university, that would be an example of a shift in policy that you were directing with that type of action. Is that correct?
Through the chair, with the caveat that I'm not directing it. It's a proposal, and it's a proposal we're making to the legislature. And ultimately, I have the burden of proof. And ultimately, the legislature controls how the budget is or is not rolled up. But I think there is some merit to it. And since we're right here, why don't I just jump to it, if you don't mind. We'll go into the granular details about cost, but our budget analysis showed that the University of Alaska campus college system is actually the most cost-effective system on a per student basis of the entire university. There was some discussion yesterday about they don't bear their full costs, and that may be true, but on a per dollar per student basis, it's quite effective from a cost perspective. And for that reason, we think that there's opportunities to leverage that. President Johnson articulated a concern and a vision, which I think has merit and should be considered. That the concern is that the state of Alaska has the lowest percentage of high school students that go on to higher education. The community campus is a solution for that, particularly if tuition were to be decreased for the community campus. So that's one of the reasons we're putting more resources towards the community campus in hopes that perhaps there's an opportunity to decrease students, to attract some of the 67% of Alaska high school students that forego higher education. I think it's a good vision. I think it's worth pursuing. President Johnson mentioned that they have a high percentage of part-time students. Standard metrics for evaluating the success of universities nationwide is the six-year graduation rate. Six-year graduation rate in University of Alaska, relatively low. Somebody asked for statistics yesterday. It's 39% for University of Alaska Fairbanks, 24% for University of Alaska Anchorage, 19% for University of Alaska Southeast. Over time, you get to 8, 9, 10 year graduation rates, it turns around and becomes much higher. Well, that's reflective of a population, a market, if you will, of higher education students that perhaps are better served by a community campus model. Again, a reason to look at the community campus model as a way to leverage the state resources and the resources the university has in a more effective way. Unfortunately, there is a certain percentage of high school students that graduate that aren't quite ready for college, and so probably a too high percentage, though it may be coming down with programs like the Alaska Performance Scholarship, a too high percentage needs remedial instruction when they arrive on campus. The community campus structure is a cost-efficient way of dealing with that. Rather than a high-cost four-year college structure, perhaps channeling those students into the community campus structure for 1 or 2 years to get that remedial instruction, get them caught up. Additionally, President Johnson spoke of the sort of the high school to work environment that we have in Alaska. People can go from high school to the mines, from high school to the oil fields. There is an opportunity for career and technical education where the community campus system can act as a bridge between high school and a higher compensated vocational profession. And so another reason to use the community campus system as to leverage that as a cost-effective way of getting high-quality education that Alaskan high school students need when they graduate. So that's a value proposition that's embedded in unrolling this into two components to address those important needs. I endorse everything that President Johnson said yesterday with respect to needs in this state. Again, you are the appropriators. We bear the burden of proof, but I'm hoping that there are some elements of what I just said that are appealing and worthy of consideration.
Representative Merrick, and then Representative Sullivan Leonard, and Josephson. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Yesterday, President Johnson mentioned that if they closed all the community campuses, that would be $38 million. So when we add $20 million, is that in addition to the 38? So basically, is it a net loss of $18 million to community campuses?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, it's certainly not any conclusion that I would like the committee to draw from what I'm saying, that we close the community campuses. But I think what President Johnson is saying, okay, if we have to take this $134 million cut, how in the world are we going to do it? And he's saying if we were to close all the community campuses, that would only add up to $38 million. And if you turn to page 17, I hate to do this, but I put a big spreadsheet on the table. You can see how it adds up. So let me just introduce this spreadsheet. This came from the University of Alaska in response to some questions we asked about relative cost between community campus and university campus. You can see that it's broken into the three parts, the main campus and the community campuses in each of the three universities. University of Alaska Anchorage at the top, University of Alaska Fairbanks in the middle, University of Alaska Southeast at the bottom. And then at the bottom of the spreadsheet, they sum the numbers by university campus and by community campus. And if you look at the community campus total, you can see it says $37 million. So what he's saying is if we were to implement this cut and I closed all of the university campuses, all I would be able to save there is $37 million. My suggestion is don't do that at all. The community campus is a solution here. It's a cost-effective structure. It provides the opportunity to provide low-cost, high-quality, and relevant higher education services to a higher percentage of Alaska young people than we are today. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I do believe there are other ways of saving costs, and I can just dive right into that if you like, or we could roll back up and I can give you some more comparison.
Follow.
So is the total budget then going to be $58 million?
The total budget.
So is it the $20 million plus what they consider, you know, the $38 million that it currently is?
Oh. That could be. I believe the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got Representative Sullivan Leonard, Josephson, Ortiz, and Johnston. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could please go back to page 11, and I'm sorry that we're going back and forth instead of going through the whole presentation, but there are questions to be asked, certainly. I wanted to talk a little bit and ask questions with regard to the land grant issue. And some of what President Johnson had talked about a little bit yesterday was with the fact that the university does have the ability to sell gravel, sell timber, and some areas of land. But in discussions with President Johnson yesterday before our meeting, he did say that there's been a challenge in the past with how the university actually has the ability to sell land, and that they are working with the administration to rectify that. And I was wondering if Mr. Barnhill could explain that a little bit further.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'll try. So land grant universities were established in the United States through the Morrill Act, which was enacted by Congress in the 1860s, 1870s, somewhere around there. It was a 19th century idea of helping higher education to be self-supporting. The University of Alaska was established in the territory in the early part of the 20th century. They did have, I can't remember exactly how many hundred million acres it was that was targeted for the University of Alaska. We got into the Constitutional Convention. The framers enacted or promulgated the dedicated funds prohibition in the convention, came out of the convention. The university went to try and select its land, and I believe the first governor of Alaska, Governor Egan, said no, that we can't do that under the dedicated funds prohibition. So this issue has been with the university since the inception of statehood. I think every administration has been sympathetic to their plight. There have been various efforts over the years to try and get the university their land grant in some fashion. It's resulted in litigation. The most recent case went to the Alaska Supreme Court, I believe in 2009. It's the SEAC, or the Southeast Alaska Conservation case, where the Supreme Court said, great idea, you can't dedicate funds, even if it's a great idea. My understanding is that the university right now is working with the federal delegation to deliver the land grant through some change in federal law. And we certainly support any effort the university makes to diversify its fund sources, to get its land grant. It is an issue that's been with us for the entirety of statehood. While I'm sympathetic, go into comparisons with other land grant universities. The percentage of revenue that the land grant universities derive from investments, on the whole, is relatively small. 1-3% of their income comes from investments, including their land grant, including their endowment. The revenue mix of land grant universities, and not just land grant universities, but any university, public, private, land grant, is going to be a mix of tuition for public universities, state sources, federal sources, private sources.
Hey, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Barnhill, we were sort of on slide 12, but also looking at slide 17. I have some questions about that. You noted that the community campuses are most cost effective, but then you said, we acknowledge that they don't bear their full burden of administrative expenses, but then after acknowledging that, you just dismissed it as if you hadn't acknowledged it and said, nonetheless, they're the most cost effective. And I'm just wondering how you do that, how you, it's not a full acknowledgement if you then dismiss it.
Through the chair, I don't think I did dismiss my own comment, but I can put it perhaps with some more detail will enlighten or highlight what I'm trying to say. There are various levels of subsidization within the university system, which is shown on page 17. In terms of the cost per student, the community campus system is the cheapest cost per student. In terms of the administration costs, let's just go to page 17. The university sets those out at the very bottom of this chart on page 17. You can, and so it's not allocated across, but you can see that it's a total of $53 million of cost to administer through the statewide services, which is inclusive of the administration of the statewide administration of the university system, as well as their technology folks and whatnot. Of that $53 million, about $18 million is unrestricted general fund. The university has not allocated those out to each of the campuses in this spreadsheet. But if they were to do that on a per student basis, it would be about $1,000 per student. So each of these per student costs in the rightmost column would be increased by about $1,000 per student. If I appeared dismissive, it was just because the allocation of the administration costs really doesn't impact materially the cost drivers that are illustrated in this spreadsheet.
I want to move on to some other questions here. One is first a comment that the president himself has acknowledged both in our subcommittee and here that the community college tuition or community campus tuition is overcharged relative to the typical or norm, and so the regents are looking at a 25% reduction to make those more appealing. So he seems to be pushing the policy in the direction you recommend. But I guess what's confusing to me is, and I'm not entirely sure, although I concede that their graph, that is the university's graph, seems to refer to community campuses as other than than the three main campuses. But if the focus is on community campuses, and I live in Anchorage, and I'm 18 years old, and I'm not yet ready for perhaps a sophisticated baccalaureate degree, is it the administration's proposal that I move to Kenai or Kodiak? Is that, I mean, that's what I don't understand is, I mean, typically, I mean, history is replete with people moving to cities, but you want this, I'm thinking of China at the moment, you want folks to move to rural Alaska, which is great, but it's, or to Matsu.
Through the chair, I think I can address your concern. And part of the difficulty here is, you know, all spreadsheets have their pros and cons. I wanted to use the university spreadsheet because I thought it would confer a higher degree of credibility than if I put one of my own in front of you. You'd be like, geez, this is Barnhill spreadsheet. But one of the difficulties with this spreadsheet is, in some instances, they have combined the University of the community campus with the main campus, and that's the case for University of Alaska. So the University of Alaska Anchorage main campus line is also inclusive of the University of Alaska Anchorage Community and Technical College, which has about 1,147 students, and so that's combined in here. So for your example, you wouldn't have to move anywhere. It's, I think of all of the community campuses, it is the biggest one. And the numbers here, it's cost effective as well. To Representative Sullivan Leonard's point, you could also go down the street to Matsu. They also have a relatively large community campus. Mr. Chair, I do want to get into page 17, but I really think it would be better if I did some of this comparison to help set a context. And I appreciate all the questions.
I just wanted to make sure, Representative Ortiz, you had a question. Was it on the last slide that we had left off.
Just go ahead and I'll come back with a question later, but let's let him proceed with the way he wants to proceed.
Great, okay. And also, as we bounce back and forth to the slides or whatever slide we're on, if we could just note that we don't have gavel to gavel today, and I think there might be some folks who are online and they're following, so we just wanted to make sure that folks could follow along. Mr. Barnhill?
So let's go back to page 12, and I just want to say at the outset that the reason I like to do comparison, it just provides a context. There's been various comments made, and they have merit, that when you compare Alaska with anybody in the lower 48, any institution, any program, whatnot, it can be an apples to oranges comparison, and I want to acknowledge that's a fair comment. Nevertheless, I have always done comparisons, whatever line of work I've done with the state of Alaska with the lower 48, if only to provide some context. So on this page 12, we are looking at data that's compiled by the State Higher Education Officers Association, CHEO. It's posted on their website. Happy to provide the link. These are two charts that compare all publicly funded universities. That's the chart on the left of the United States in terms of government appropriations, tuition, and enrollment. And then the chart on the right is Alaska. The blue part of the bar is the government appropriation. The green part of the bar is the tuition. And then the red line is enrollment. And this is a time period from 1992 to 2017. The numbers expressed in inflation-adjusted dollars, 2017 dollars. But what we can see in 2017 is that the national average appropriation from the state is $7,642. It's varied over time. In 2001, it peaked at over $9,000. It's come down since, probably as a result of the Great Recession in 2009. Alaska on the right is more than twice that. In 2017, Alaska support was over $16,000, and that's come down as well. It hit a peak in 2014 and 2015. Alaska's on the right-hand chart.
Question, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barnhill, the university makes the point, and there's a well-written, I would submit, document from a former provost named Susan Henricks, which I'm still working my way through. But it makes the point that this comparison is flawed. I mean, it may be mathematically accurate and not flawed in that respect. But for example, we have no community college system. We have virtually no contribution from local communities to the university system. And the principal, or sorry, the principal, the president makes the point that I think it was in the range of $50 million would have been sort of the statistical equivalent of what is not received in that category. This report I referred to also says that in the auxiliary category, and I frankly didn't know what that meant, but it refers to monies and fees raised from things like residential halls and the like. There's very little of that sort of revenue. And then, of course, you have the cost of living differential, the geographic spread. Given all of those factors, how is making this comparison helpful to us?
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, comparisons in and of themselves to set context are never going to be flawed. They just provide a context. You've given me, okay, apples to oranges, and I've already acknowledged, okay, apples to oranges. I did get Susan Henricks' paper was sent to me, and later on I'll get into the budget development. And if you haven't heard it already, we took this number, the 7,642, and applied a multiplier to reflect increased costs of 44%. And, of course, I didn't have the benefit of Susan Henrich's paper when we were working on the budget development, but on page 9 she says we should use a 30% multiplier. And I was like, okay, 40% starts to sound reasonable. But again, context. And the context, the point here is Alaska appropriates, and this is different than cost, but appropriates for support a higher amount than most other states, roughly twice as much. So why don't we go ahead and turn over to page 13. And here the source of information, here we're comparing against land-grant universities. Could have compared Alaska against publicly funded universities, but I chose just to confine it to land-grant universities, a smaller subset, and University of Alaska, I think, is proud of its land-grant heritage and includes that reference quite frequently. So there's approximately 100 land-grant universities in the country. And this is from a database that is on the website of the National Center for Education Statistics. It's their IPEDS database, and for the record, that stands for Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System. Anybody can get into that website and click on, they've got hundreds of data points. You can click on whatever you want and make whatever comparison you want. And the reason why I say that is because, with respect to Representative Josephson, there are apples and oranges issues here. And so I'm making this resource known and available to you, so if your staff have spare time, they can get in and do their own comparisons and come back and tell me why I'm all wet. But this particular comparison is just comparing land-grant universities with respect to the percentage of support, the percentage of the revenues they get from the state. And you can see the top five are displayed here on page 13, University of Alaska Fairbanks coming in at 43% of support. I want to say that for purposes of this database, it's just the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The data doesn't include University of Alaska Anchorage or University of Alaska Southeast. I don't know the reason for that, but the 43% is fairly consistent. You heard President Johnson say that in the FY19 budget they were getting 36% of their support from unrestricted general fund. In other depictions of the relative percentage of state support, for instance, the University of Alaska has a slide deck that they've posted online on February 13th, shows the percentage of state support over a period of time. It's coming in at 42% in that particular depiction. So, anyways, the point is relatively high. And then we turn over to page 14, and here's a snapshot of universities at the lower, land-grant universities at the lower end of state support. And again, I fully acknowledge apples to oranges, but what I'm trying to show here is it's possible. It's possible for a land-grant university to exist with a lower percentage of state support, and here's a subset of those that do. Again, I get there's a variety of reasons why that might be, and I believe in subcommittee the other day it was mentioned, some of these have law schools, and some of these have medical schools, and some of these have basketball teams, and those are all reasons why they can survive with a lower percentage of state support. And I want to urge the committee to recognize the possibility that the University of Alaska has its own set of unique features that can enable them to walk down that path, leverage those features, and thrive with lower state support.
Got a lot of Questions on this one? Representative Johnston, then Wilson, Josephson, and Ortiz. Representative Johnston.
Well, I too love stories and love looking at data. And these, you're telling some great stories here. One, when of course your first page, you've got Kentucky State University and University of Alaska Fairbanks. The next slide is wonderful because you actually point out that there's university systems and there's state college or state university systems. Of course, on here we don't have the difference in community colleges and location. I would love to tell the story of University of Vermont because that is a state I'm quite familiar with, and that's where Senator Morrill came from, who is the land grant, the farther land grant legislation. Anyways, you know, that's the lowest down here. And they have a smaller population than Alaska, and it's very rural. They also have very little economy. They also have a community college system, a state college system, and a university system. I was just trying to look it up, the state system is for in-state tuition is about $10,000, $11,000. University itself, the in-state tuition is close to $17,000. The out-of-state contribution is $40,000. And as I say, this is a state with really relatively little economy. The only economy is that it is in a it has Montreal to the north, Portland to the east, Boston to the south, and New York to the west. And so what they have is rural mountains and La La Land. But anyways, what they have is they're able to market to the out-of-state or the metro areas, these colleges. But again, no economic base. So I guess we could do that in Alaska. In some respect, but probably not at that level. Other ones here, I'm just looking at this list. It's a fascinating list. You look at the California. We know that California has a robust university system, and then they have a robust state system, and then they have a robust community college system, and they feed into each other. And their tuitions are matched accordingly. Oregon State, another one. One of the great sort of little secrets about Oregon is that I had many friends here in Alaska who have had children to go down and they enroll in the community college system in Oregon so that they can become in-state, so that they can get in-state tuition in the state university and the University of Oregon. There are wonderful stories here. And I think you've pushed maybe the borders of your stories, but I would like to say, and maybe this is what you're trying to emphasize, is that what we have in the state is a university system and we have a community college system. But we don't have what these other states have, which is a community college system that feeds into a state system that feeds into a university system. And maybe is that what you're trying to suggest?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I'm probably trying to suggest a number of things all at once. First, setting context for sort of parameters on what is the high water and the low water for state support for publicly funded universities, so we can see a context. But I think secondarily, the stories speak to possibilities. the stories, if you will, speak to ways in which publicly funded universities have been able to leverage things that are unique to them in order to diversify their funding sources and survive and thrive on what they have. I guess I would say, and this is somewhat related to that, that there are examples and lessons learned and experience and expertise in every one of these lines that can be tapped into for ideas, ideas, wisdom, plans, ways of executing a path forward that I think are valuable, that can be taken advantage of. But for purposes of what we're getting to on page 17, what I am trying to do is provide a context for revenues and expenses.
And just follow up. And were you trying to suggest this line of thinking when you had Kentucky State University that has one of the highest percentage of revenues from the state? And then you, of course, had University of Kentucky on this other lowest. Anything you were trying to point out there?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, no. It's just Kentucky State University just happens to be in the top five. And the slice on page 14 from Oregon State down to University, those are land-grant universities that are less than 20%. I can provide, happy to, the totality of all of these spreadsheets to your staff. It's been provided to the other body, and you guys can slice, dice, and sort, and draw whatever other conclusions you'd like to.
Thank you.
I'd like to recognize that we were joined in the audience by Representative Zolkowski. Thanks for being here. We've got questions from Representative Wilson, Josephson, and Ortiz. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when we're talking about the land grant, and this is something that I've tried to figure out here, the other land grant universities, is there any kind of comparison to the type of land, the accessibility, what percentage that they have? Because I truly believe that is probably something we haven't tapped probably to the extent that we need to, but I've always been told that where the land is for the university here are in areas that are very hard to get to and doesn't have really the revenue generation that we have that the state chose.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I have not done any comparison of land grants. I believe the university has a slide or at least a chart that shows the land grant universities and their actual acreage and various ways of looking at that. But in the chart, the University of Alaska comes out towards the bottom. But what I have done with the assistance of this database that shows all of the revenue sources of land-grant universities is just compute the investment income as a percentage of all revenues, and I'm assuming that includes revenues from the land-grant portions of these university endowments. And the investment piece tends to be a relatively small piece across the board.
Follow-up. And I guess my point is I've just never been able to get a clear answer of exactly what the problem is being able to sell the land or get to the land. And so if we're going to compare land universities with our land university, I'd just like to know whether or not they're in more populated areas they could get there. But I'll continue on that one. But my other question is when you were talking about the additional $20 million going to community campuses, are you looking at actually making it two separate, not just moving the $20 million, but using the entire grant that the state has and saying this portion of it is going to go to, I guess, statewide, which seems very odd, and the other part can only go to community colleges, or are you actually going to divide up and say, here's the money for that we expect or in the budget process that would go to UAS, UAF, and UAA, and this amount of money we want accounted for in the community colleges? You can't just move the $20 million. That doesn't make any sense. I'm just trying to figure out how this restructuring you're looking at and how it would work.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the overarching point that we're trying to make is that there's, I think, substantial opportunities in the community campus system to add resources and meet higher education needs of young Alaskans. How that actually gets implemented, if we end up with a budget that's rolled into two components, University of Alaska and Community Campus, how the university decides to actually implement that, whether they separate out, as Representative Johnson just suggested, into a completely separate community campus system that feeds into a college, that feeds into a, or a state college, into a university system, or whether it remains within the context of one university and one community campus administration. That's the university's discretion to plan for that and to implement that. But what we're trying to do from a budget policy perspective is highlight there are opportunities in the community campus system. There are opportunities because there are needs that President Johnson has identified, and there's a cost-effective structure that exists today. Notwithstanding the point that others have made that local communities don't contribute as much to our community college system as happens in other states, it's still cost-effective.
Follow-up? I'm not picking a fight. I'm really just trying to get the accountability portion of it. If we're trying to change behavior, which kind of sounds like we're looking at that, a possibility, possibly going more into the community, you know, college, you know, framework, which I don't disagree, you know, with that. But what I'm just really trying to figure out is when they come, because right now I think we're probably confusing the public, because we give it as a grant at this point. So we say, here, Regents, here's the amount of money, go spend it, you know, and we have to take some of that blame for it, because as we had money, we really told the university, go be all you can be, spend it, do good things. And then when they did and we don't have any money, they were like, well, why did you get so big, when we're actually the ones, I think, that drove the train kind of the way it is right now. The legislature, not the administration, because we, at the end of the day, made these grants. What I'm trying to figure out now, though, really is just a simple math issue, is that if we are truly trying to change behavior, the only way we could really do that is to say this amount of money we want to go into our campuses or into our more local campuses. Here's what we want to do for the big three. When you come back next year, that's how we want you to report it. So I'm just trying to figure out if that's what we're trying to do, or we're just saying, kind of just giving a little nudge. We'd like you to spend the $20 million over here and take it. But at the end of the day, we're not going to get into the details any more than we have in the past.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, and I don't perceive anything you're saying as picking a fight. I'm actually enjoying the discussion. These are good questions. I think more the latter is this is proposed as a nudge.
Okay. Well, that helps to know, because I think if we really want to change behavior, then we would make it that direction. So Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bernhild, I guess one thing I'm trying to figure out is this effort to infuse the community campuses with more energy. I haven't heard enough about whether there is unmet need. In other words, if somebody wants to take a class that typically might be found in a community college curricula, I just don't know enough about whether those classes are filled in the state right now. Do you have any thought about that?
So, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think the unmet need was articulated, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, but articulated by President Johnson yesterday when he said that, I think these are the numbers, he said only 30-some percent of Alaska high school graduates go on to college. And the unmet need is the product, if you will, the higher education product that will attract that 60-some percent of high school graduates that are simply forsaking higher education as something that's useful for them in their life. And quite frankly, I think that vision has merit and is compelling. So the question is, okay, here's the unmet need. There's 67% of high school students that are just saying, I don't need higher education. I'm in no way trying to suggest that all 60% should go to college. They shouldn't. But certainly there is a subset, maybe a large subset of folks, that if we tailored a community campus program to their needs, they would go. And that would bring students to the university. And I think you heard President Johnson, and it's in various charts, one of the biggest challenges the university has faced is they've lost enrollment substantially. It's down 20% since 2012. That's a fairly shocking reduction in enrollment. And so I believe the need is there.
Hello?
Well, just actually one thing I wanted to point out in relative to slide 13, and Mr. Burnhill noted, and I don't blame him in the slightest, that the NCES source on slide 13 was only reflected UAF. But if we look at the actual UGF as a percentage of the total $881 million, it's close. It's really under 37%, and it strikes me that if we then had a list of universities and colleges between 43% and 37%, we would find, I'm going to guess, the University of Alaska still in the top third, but not as so obviously in the top five schools. Is that possible?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, I'm happy to provide the whole chart. I honestly don't remember who comes number six, but I'm turning to a page in the University of Alaska's budget overview, February 13th, 2019 slide deck. And the reason why the 43% resonated with me is because on their FY14 to FY19 operating budget revenue by source, it's essentially the same number that they give. And so I think it's validated on a university basis. And I'll just read into the record. FY14, 47.2% UGF. FY15, 47.5%. FY16, 45%. FY17, 43%. And I should say that this data is 2016-2017 data. FY18, 42%, FY19 projection, 42.4%. So, there's a variety of ways of slicing and dicing the data. I think the number's accurate, and the point I'm trying to convey is it's on the high end.
Okay. Just to follow up, I guess the confusion is when I look at your slide at page 9, it says FY19 management plan, UGF, $327 million, and the total is $887, and that appears to be a fraction of 36.8%. So we'll sort this out off record.
Through the chair, the differences are in how you count various funding sources, to what extent is there hollow authority in a funding source. I believe there are hollow authorities in the existing and has been for a while within the university. We could spend all day.
We have questions, and then we'll probably finish the presentation and see if the questions are answered in that. But we'll finish up with Representative Ortiz. We have one for Representative Sullivan Linder before.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, going back to the land grant questions that you came up with, and I guess just to provide a little bit more detail to that, and then maybe making the point that, again, it's another example of an apples to oranges comparison when we talk about comparing land-grant universities. It's my understanding that the university system has received only 25% of the allotted land grant that they were supposed to receive, and they're still owed 360,000 acres. Was that looked into, those kind of specifics looked into as to these other areas that we've made these comparisons with?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, only to the extent that in this database it shows percentage of revenues from investment income. And this database tends to show that in terms of the overall revenue sources mix, the percentage of revenues from investment income tends to be relatively low across this subset of higher education institutions.
So just for clarity, then, there wasn't that kind of comparison looking at which university systems received have received like 100% of their land grants compared to the University of Alaska system, which has only received 25%. Is that correct? That comparison was not made.
Well, I guess through the chair, it was made in that I have the revenue data from all of the land grant universities, and provide it to you, and you can draw your own conclusions. But it doesn't show that investment income is a material source of revenue for any of these land grant universities.
And I think the bottom line is you can't make money off of land you don't have yet.
Right.
So it probably would not be in the data. Representative Sovin-Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I know we need to move along here, so I'll make it quick. But just with regard to the $20 million that that the administration is looking at investing with our outlying campuses, I think it's a real smart move with regard to the incredible need for health care positions in our rural areas. In my discussion with President Johnson yesterday was such that, you know, those investments are going to hit out to the various campuses so that nursing jobs are going to be looked at and placed in areas that are vitally important, nursing assistants, dental assistants, health care aides. So, you know, with that mindset and also knowing that you're going to have a nursing instructor in those particular areas, I think is really a smart move. And maybe it's just not being articulated today what that $20 million could be used for. But when you look at the jobs in the market and where they're most needed across the state of Alaska, I think that's a smart investment. So anyway, sorry, I just want to make that statement.
Good point. Thank you very much. And we've been joined by Representative LeBon. We want to make sure you didn't miss out, so we kept going on. So you may go ahead and finish your presentation if you we can. Unless there's something on that particular slide that's.
Let's go on to page 15, Madam Chair. So this is a slide that shows cost per student, cost per FTE, full-time equivalent student. Again, same database, deriving it from total expenses divided by the number of students. And here we see the University of Alaska Fairbanks, again, just Fairbanks. Coming in at $73,000. This is the top 15 or so, $73,000 per student, so relatively high. Again, one thing I want to call out, this is different than the number you'll see from the university on page 17. And the reason is I believe that the expenses for the research group at the University of Alaska Fairbanks have been combined into this. And so I think, and the university explicitly doesn't do that because that's different. They have three core services, education, research, and public service. They take pains to pull out research when they calculate FTE. And I think that's the correct way of doing it. So if you pull the research out of this number, it drops it to somewhere around $59,000 per student, which is consistent with the university's data. But again, it tends to be on the higher end. Jumping over to 16, again, just the population of land-grant universities, here's how the per-student costs break out across this population of approximately 100. The upper quartile is 50,000 or more per student. University of Alaska falls into that. The middle two quartiles, the expenses run between $25,000 and $50,000 per student, and then the bottom decile, if you will, is less than $25,000. So it gives you a sense of the median cost per student in the country at land-grant universities is, you know, between $25,000 and $50,000. And we've been talking for an hour, and this is really the punchline that leads us into page 17. So sorry for the big spreadsheet. You may want to take this offline and study it and bring me back for lots more great questions. I'm happy to do that. But again, this is a spreadsheet from the university. This is just their education core service. They have pulled out from this chart expenses and revenues related to research. That's about $37 million in unrestricted general fund. They pulled out expenses and revenue related to public service. That's about $30 million in unrestricted general fund revenue. And they've also pulled out expenses and revenue related to auxiliary services, which is Representative Joseph and indicated earlier, auxiliary services are like dormitory and cafeteria and whatnot. So if you look at the bottom line numbers, you'll see they don't line up neatly with the total budget because this is just education. Each of the main campuses and community campuses are listed here. You can see their general fund. I'm just reading through the columns. Their general fund, their tuition and fees, their federal, local if they have it, total revenue, and then they've got a metric of percentage of tuition to revenue. You can see the differences amongst the various campuses. And then finally, expenditures. FTE is the full-time equivalent student, and then finally expenditures per FTE. I mentioned it earlier, but in a couple cases they've combined their university with their community campus numbers and students, and that's true for the University of Alaska main campus that combines in the University of Alaska Anchorage Community and Technical campus, and it's also true for University of Alaska. They've combined in their School of Education. In other spreadsheets the university has, they disaggregate those and display them separately as community schools. They haven't done that here. But really what I want to draw your attention to are the boxes that are flagged in yellow. And we spent a long time sort of creating context, and you know, page 16 seems to suggest that median costs in the lower 48 for land-grant universities range between $25,000 and $50,000. And the University of Alaska Anchorage campus is coming in at the bottom end of that, at $25,000 per student. And when I saw this, I was like, that's amazing. We spent the past hour talking about apples to oranges, about how Alaska is so much more expensive than the rest of the country, but yet most of the students in the University of Alaska system are in a cost structure that is cost competitive with the lower 48. The University of Alaska is actually succeeding from a cost perspective. I don't want to either understate or overstate the significance of that, but that wasn't what I expected to see from this data. We drop down to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the number is substantially higher. We've already talked about it, and you know, amongst land-grant universities, it's pretty high. Now, we could fairly attribute a portion of this very high cost to higher costs, not only in Alaska, but also in Fairbanks. It's not going to quarrel with that at all. But what I want to suggest is, and again, these are per unit or per full-time equivalent student numbers, that it's not cost, it's not higher cost that's driving this particular figure, it's lower students. Harkening back to, you know, President Johnson referenced, we've had declining enrollment. Their slides show enrollment's down 20% since 2012. The costs are going up at Fairbanks because fewer students are enrolled there. I don't have all the reasons for why that is, but what I would like to suggest is there's a scale problem here, and that's the scale problem that we brought to the governor. That's the scale problem that is informing this budget reduction. And we think there are opportunities for scale through consolidation. Now, the way it's been phrased is it's sort of an either or. We must close UAF, we must close UAA. I don't think that's what we're proposing. I think there are a variety of ways of achieving scale. But the importance to me is these numbers show that they are educating the majority of their students in a cost-effective structure. And I believe those cost-effective structures can be achieved in any location, quite frankly. They just need to work on that path, and I think they are. I think President Johnson indicated that they have direction from the regions. That direction's been present for quite a while. That consolidation is important, not only for cost purposes, but for also quality. I mean, you've got two engineering schools, you've got multiple education schools, you've got multiple business schools, you have multiple colleges of arts and sciences. And when you fragment in a small state like this, your programs across multiple campuses, multiple university campuses, you're doubling, tripling your operations and maintenance costs, you're blurring focus on quality, and I think, unfortunately, the University of Alaska Anchorage has experienced that recently. There's an opportunity to scale here through consolidation into cost structures that exist today.
And also in the UAF numbers, I believe the statewide programs are that tier is actually in these numbers, which causes UAF to look a lot higher. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, if I could, please. Looking at the spreadsheet here, it looks like MATSU does not receive federal funding like the other universities do, and I just want to know if you could highlight that a bit for me.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I have no details for that. I don't know.
Agricultural, maybe?
I have no idea.
Okay. We will pose that to the university and find out. I also want to make sure that I think the frustration you're hearing out is the committee is really not understanding how you got to your numbers and to your comparison and trying to better understand that as we make some very hard, difficult decisions. So, you know, charts are great, but we want to make sure that we're as close comparing universities that are similar to ours and not just finding numbers that make it look better for the reason that we that the cut was brought forward. So any other questions right now? You may move on.
Yeah, and through the chair, thank you for that comment. What I'm trying to do is make as transparent as possible the thinking and the analysis that went into this budget cut. It's important. And absolutely, please quarrel with me and with these numbers. It's important to the process. The next page, what I've done is just set out a column to the right of the chart. These are my calculations now. And this just shows the general fund per student contribution for each of the main campuses. And you can see for University of Alaska, it's just under 11,000. For the University of Alaska Fairbanks, it's just under 32,000. UAS, 21,000. Community campus total is 8,400. And then university total is just double that. It's 17,374 total. With respect to the administration costs, Representative, Madam Chair, you just indicated that you believed the administration costs were built into that 59,000. That's not my understanding, but I will take correction if my understanding is incorrect. My understanding is that the administration costs are displayed at the very bottom two lines of this graph, and they're not allocated up into these numbers. And that was a problem that was addressed to me in saying that these are the total numbers, when in fact they're not the total numbers. And what I was trying to do earlier was say, okay, if you take that $1,100 of administration costs and move it up into those allocations, then it would make the University of Alaska general fund per student number go up to 11,800. It would make the UAF number go up to 32,900, make the UAS number go up to the 22,000. But really what just setting administration aside, just again, what I'm trying to show here is that the community campus number, despite the fact it doesn't have local contributions, except as shown on this chart, is half of the university number. It's a cost-effective structure. It's a cost-effective structure locally and on national terms that can be used to meet unmet needs of young Alaskans. And then finally, page 19, and then we'll be done with dense slides. Add a second column to the right, and this is not a plan. It's not a recommendation. It's a scenario. I guess it's a what if. What if the main campuses, these three main university campuses, were structured, had a cost structure like the University of Alaska Anchorage? So I'm just swapping out numbers, taking that $24,000 per student and inserting it for University of Alaska Fairbanks and University of Alaska Southeast. And in so doing, I'm not saying close University of Alaska Fairbanks or close University of Alaska Southeast. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we have a cost structure now in Anchorage that does this. Can we replicate that? If we did, what are the savings? And what I'm showing is approximately $92 million worth of savings.
Professor Josephson.
Thank you. Thank you, Manager. Mr. Burnhill, one of the things that hasn't been evaluated, but you've helped in this respect, I look forward to asking the president or his staff about what extra costs are associated with UAF. I know that when I tour the campus, which is roughly annually, at least drive through it, I'm impressed by the sophistication of the programs, most of which I couldn't begin to understand because I was a history and law student. And that they don't, those programs aren't mirrored at UAA. UAA has different programs and equally brilliant students, but there are differences, particularly in the applied sciences and Arctic studies and those sorts of things. But what you haven't answered, I see your point about Anchorage, and I'm, as a citizen of Anchorage, I'm aware of its sort of, I mean, generally speaking, it's much less expensive to do business there than, for example, here, certainly in the area of medical care and housing and the like. But what I don't have an answer yet to is there's got to be more going on here than meets the eye. In other words, we see that you've promoted the idea of community campuses. They're very expensive in rural Alaska. That's evident on page 18. That is no indication that I think we should do something else with our rural campuses. I'm a former twice resident of rural Alaska, and that isn't where I'm headed, but they are more expensive. Kenai, Kodiak, and Matsu, certainly Kenai and Matsu have the proximity factor. But I guess what I don't know, and I think the university is the best source, is why UAF is more expensive. And I'm assuming that we couldn't just apply a UAA economic model and come out in the same place.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yeah, I believe the issue is scale. The reason why costs per unit costs are high is because scale is down in every one of these cases. The outlying community campuses are more expensive, but there are fewer students there, so they're not really driving costs on an aggregate average basis. They're the lowest costs. That's because you've got scale at the community campuses that are more centrally located. University of Alaska Fairbanks' difficulty is they've lost students, and they're not attracting students. So there are opportunities there, and the issue is not so much cost, I believe, for University of Alaska. The issue is how we scale. So when you scale, you get better per unit costs.
We'll look forward to the subcommittee diving into that a little bit more, because I do believe that's a question for the president. Yes. And I think what the administration is trying to say, to hold the campus open, it costs so much, no matter whether there's one student there or, you know, 50,000 students there. And so it's probably a good discussion to have in your subcommittee on actually how many full-time students versus on just students at all. So we've been joined by Representative Carpenter. Thank you. We are on page 20.
So, Madam Chair, the rest of the slides I can probably stampede through, much to the gratefulness, I'm sure, of the committee, because we've talked about most of these things. So there's opportunity for tuition versus the university and the community campuses. President Johnson's covered this. If tuition goes down in the community campuses, funding goes up, there could be a response of increased enrollment there. Going on to page 22, core services, and this is more just a summary here. They have three core services: education, research, public service. We've really focused the entirety of our conversation on the primary core service, which is delivering education. Our appraisal is the university would benefit from focusing on cost-effective delivery of high-quality education. They are succeeding in the University of Alaska Anchorage and community campus context. We observe, don't make any recommendations, that there appear to be similar programs in multiple locations, multiple schools of arts and sciences, engineering, education, and business. There's opportunities for consolidation. We haven't really spent any time talking about research. Research is a $37 million unrestricted general fund core service. President Johnson is rightly proud of the work they do. He wants to maintain the research unit in Fairbanks as an engine. They do leverage a substantial amount of federal dollars, 6-to-1. Research I've done suggests there are more opportunities there. I'm not suggesting that it can be done overnight, but Michigan State University in their last annual report has a pie chart of all the federal sources that they leverage, and the state source is minuscule, 29-to-1. So there, we encourage the university to walk this path aggressively. Make the University of Alaska Fairbanks the premier Arctic university, research university in the world. Attract people with that. That's a marketing proposition that I think could be quite attractive, not just to Alaskans, not just to U.S. citizens, but to the planet. And then finally, public service. We've spent no time talking about this. In their descriptive materials, this is a $30 million unrestricted general fund allocation. They distribute 190,000 publications. They do cooperative extension services. They provide services to small businesses. We think $30 million is a high cost, and there's opportunities for designated general fund receipt-supported build out here so that this is more of a self-supporting core service. Page 23 is just the calculation. This is how we got to the reduction, the $134 million reduction. We took, going back to the very first set of slides from the State Higher Education Officers Association, that average cost of $7,642 per student amongst public universities in the United States. We picked I call it the Alaska multiplier, 40% to account for higher costs. Rounded that up to 11,000, so it's a 44% multiplier. I will say it's coincidental, but significant to me that that's the GF per student cost at the University of Alaska Anchorage. We think that's a good and appropriate and achievable target because most of the students in the University of Alaska structure are under a cost structure that this would meet. And then in terms of rolling the appropriation into two components, we took the populations at the community campus according to the University of Alaska data and just rolled it out. So 5611 students times 11,000 is the campus community component of $61.7 million. 11,944 students times $11,000 is the university component of $131.4 million. You go back to 17, if you were paying attention, you'll see that those numbers are different. And the reason they're different on page 17 again is that they've rolled up the community campus for UAA and UAS, and we've unrolled those for purposes of this calculation. Total UGF, unrestricted general fund appropriation, the total campus full-time equivalent times $11,000.
Alderman Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a very quick question. With regard to the total UGF appropriation, are you also looking at the PFD contribution to students through their UA account as maybe state funds coming in to help support students and the university system?
Through the chair.
Being calculated?
Through the chair, no. No, that would be personal resources. So when people take their PFD and they do the 50% check off, which I've done, you've done, those are personal resources that go to pay the tuition that's charged. Okay, just a few more slides. We've talked a lot about over reliance on state funding, the fact that, you know, the University of Alaska is relatively high. Whether it's 36% or 40% or higher, that's been noted. The University of Alaska has been downgraded twice by Moody's for over-reliance on state funding since 2015. It's not just the Dunleavy administration pointing this out. It's been an issue for a while. I also make the point, the university put in their slides that the university is established in the Constitution. That makes it a core function. Not to put a too fine point on it, it is established. It's functionally a public corporation established in the Constitution. But there's no language in the Constitution that requires state funding. Everywhere else in Article 6, establish and maintain, provide for the university. It's just established. That doesn't mean that it's not super important for a variety of reasons, and it's not worthy of support. It's just not, the support is not constitutionally driven.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my point on this would be predictable, and just that. The same is true of the constitutional mandate to provide for public health and public education. It's not something the founders in 1955 would have put in a constitution because it doesn't go there. We don't do that in constitutions.
So we're not going to have that debate.
Okay.
we're going to move on, but thank you for that point. I agree with you. It would not be in the constitution if our founders did not find it very important. But as far as we can get in that debate with that or education, but I think we'll finish the slides instead.
Much as I would love to have that debate. So page 25, Madam Chair, Representative Josephson asked for examples of other universities that have walked this path. The Pennsylvania universities have struggled with state funding for decades. I'm from Pennsylvania, so I have some personal familiarity with that. But starting in the 70s and 80s, the local economy went into a depression. All the steel mills closed. I can't tell you for certain that they endured cuts of this magnitude in 1 year. I don't know the answer to that. I did try to research that. I have a memory of substantial reductions happening to public universities in Pennsylvania in a short period of time. I know that in the Penn State University context, more recently, Governor Corbett, and he's not the current governor, but we're talking like 5 years ago, did propose a 50% reduction in their state funding. I don't know what the outflow of that ultimately was. But what I've provided the committee here is an example from the University of Pittsburgh, which is where I'm from. And last year, you can see they have stepped down over decades from, and I believe that their support was substantially higher than 24% in 1980, prior to 1985. But what they have done is stepped down to 7.5%. And in the past year, unilaterally, the regents have said, well, what do we do if all state funding disappears? We need to scenario plan for this. And my point in saying that is it is possible for universities to be thinking proactively. They are thinking proactively. It's possible for this university in Alaska to do the same. Moody's told the university in 2015, you're over-relying on state funding. Fast forward to budget development for FY20, they saw an increment in state funding. I think there's a legitimate policy concern there, and what we're trying to do here is say the path to success is in the other direction.
Representative Josephson.
Well, just through the chair, my staff has found that some of the schools you've highlighted, Oregon State University, Clemson, and UC Berkeley, are all currently crying for additional funding. They can't sustain the level of funding that they're speaking of. And relative to the Moody's downgrade, the state itself was downgraded a couple times, and there's got to be a correlation there, does there not, Mr. Barnhill?
I thought about, through the chair, again, you know, listen, all stakeholders for funds are crying for funds across the country, across the world. I'm in a situation as policy director for OMB. There isn't funds. There just isn't. So where's the path to success? I thought about putting the Moody's downgrade quote in the slide deck so you could see it, but it's different than the state downgrade. I mean, the state downgrade is over-reliance on well revenues. The downgrade for the university is over-reliance on state funding.
Just a follow-up.
A question.
Yes. You've just, I think, hit the nail on the head. The state downgrade is due to an over-reliance on oil revenues. This whole budget is about reliance on oil revenues, isn't it? What else does the budget rely on?
So the budget is our budget at this point, not their budget? What I do appreciate about, you know, and I'm sure Mr. Barnhill wants to be anywhere but here right now.
No, I love it. Bring it on.
What I want to add to that, though, is that what I do appreciate about this presentation is with slide 22 as well as 26, which we're going to go to now, is that there are actual suggestions on, I think, things that you could take back to the subcommittee and have that conversation with the president who needs to have it. I think really what the governor is trying to do is maybe that's not the right amount that he picked, and that's what the debate, and maybe it is, that discussion has to have. But there are a lot of efficiencies that the university can do, but I think one thing I'm taking away from it right now is, and we've had the discussion the last few years, is we have to be more competitive because we're losing students to other people who come in here who have online courses and have other types, taking our students maybe not physically away from the state, but away from our university on that. And I really appreciate that point that, you know, as our student enrollment possibly decreases, our costs don't decrease. And therefore, it makes every student there that's still there cost more, even though the same programs, you know, are being done. But at least there's suggestions in here that I think you could take back to the subcommittee.
I agree.
On it. And so I just want to let them know that. I do appreciate that portion. So with that, we're going to go to slide 26.
Well, this is just wrap up, Madam Chair, and I want to say thank you for all these great questions, and I really appreciate the discussion. I get it's difficult. It is difficult, but these are important questions. So the first bullet point says path. It should say a path. There's an infinite number of paths forward, but state funding for higher education has declined nationally. Universities in response have sharpened their focus on their core education products. Yesterday, President Johnson talked about exactly that. What's core? University research, community campus could be core. Some of their important programs around nursing and medicine could be core. Universities are aggressively competing for tuition dollars. To aggressively compete means you have to have a top quality core product that you're aggressively marketing not only to the state but to the country and the world. And it seems to me like the university is in that process of trying to identify how they can aggressively compete. Again, fundraising dollars from across the spectrum, private, corporate, alumni, federal, state, The university has begun its first university-wide fundraising. That's good. I would suggest it's a bit late, but it is the right path. They've got strengths. This university is operating most of its students within a cost-effective structure. They have the model. They just need to implement it. And so I guess I would conclude that, yes, this is a disruptive budget reduction. This is a difficult budget reduction. But at the end of the day, we believe they can operate at a lower per unit cost because they're doing it now. They can consolidate programs because they're doing it now. They can operate a world-class university with less funding. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for being late, and if you've already discussed this, then I'll catch the video.
Totally have.
So, yeah. As we look at a path forward and focusing on fundraising, I question, do we have, be delicate here, do we have the right talent in the right place from an entrepreneurial focus to turn the ship around or adjust the ship's course?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the answer is yes. And I just said it. They can do it because they are doing it.
Thank you.
Seeing no, Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The perfect storm we're in is the declining enrollment, particularly at UAF, and it pushes their cost per student up. The challenge then, of course, is to put more bodies in the seats at UAF in particular. Just wondering if that's achievable to recruit students and grow enrollment with cuts this large. And I'm going to go back to that University of Pittsburgh chart that you showed. It shows a 30-year timeline to reduce the state support from 24% to 7%. That looks like a pretty soft landing to me versus the crash and burn that's being proposed. So my question to you is, how did enrollment play out during that 30-year period?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, I'm not going to argue that the reduction that's being proposed is disruptive, but I do believe there is a path forward, both with respect to attracting and retaining students, as well as implementing this in a way that is sustainable and achievable. As far as the University of Pittsburgh, I believe that there were times, I'll have to get you more information, on which the cuts were quite abrupt. In terms of where they are today, they're a thriving state university with a fairly high or a fairly low admissions rate. It's a competitive school to get into.
Follow up. And I guess that was the point of my question is Pennsylvania identified a challenge. Using the University of Pittsburgh as your model for that challenge, started a program to reduce state support, and I suspect that they did this with the goal of not running students off, but to keep growing enrollment. I suspect that any success in that is the soft landing approach that they follow. Maybe that was by accident more than by design. But if we make this huge cut to the University of Alaska, whether it impacts Fairbanks or UAA or the community colleges, we're chasing off students. I don't see that happening any other way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I would hope that the subcommittee chair would look at that a little bit more, and maybe even the relationship between the community colleges. Has that become more popular, and is that why maybe some of the major colleges are seeing that drop off? But that would be a great conversation to have, and also to compare to this one. Any other questions? Seeing none, our next meeting is scheduled for this afternoon. Thursday, March 14th at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we will hear the department budget overviews of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Department of Fish and Game. So come with your questions. And with that, it's 10:49, and we are adjourned.